Hello and welcome to the Radio Academy podcast. My name is Christian Hugill, and every week we take a look at a particularly brilliant recent project from the world of podcasts and radio to either see what we can all learn from its success or just to be a bit nosy about how they did it. But this week's episode is a little bit different. We've got highlights of the 2022 Radio Academy Festival. Now, the festival is the biggest gathering of the UK radio and audio industry, and this year, 400 delegates heard speeches, workshops and presentations from presenters, producers, station bosses and loads more besides. Now, this year's event was held at the Royal College of Physicians in London, and coming up in the next hour or so, we'll hear from the team at TalkSport on how they went about covering an international football tournament in the pandemic, and BBC Radio 2's Michelle Visage on her love for radio. But first, the event started with a word from the BBC's Chief Content Officer, Charlotte Moore.
As we begin this year's Radio Festival, I do want to salute the last 100 years of radio services in the UK. I think it's a fantastic industry. And for us all to take a moment, really, to reflect on why we do what we do every day and how it really does touch people's lives, and why we're all here celebrating the enduring power of radio. As Emma said, that Avenger team of people all really trying to inspire people to love radio. And it's funny to think how often we've heard about the death of radio, only to see itself reinvent itself again and again and again. And yes, there are challenges, but I think, like so many of us here, we're all excited by the challenges, because with every challenge comes that next moment to really reinvent. And we've had some great ambitions at the BBC, and I know there are many people here today with lots of extraordinary, innovative plans as well about how we reinvent in this world of so much choice. And when I look back to the programme, and look ahead to the programme rather for today, and all the inspiring things that you're going to be discussing, from metaverse to sustainability, I think it's really humbling to think that we're all gathered here because of that something that happened 100 years ago with that little box that those men in sheds came up with. We've got a lot to thank them for. It really was the birth of BBC Radio, but it's to everyone in this room, everyone in this industry who's helped secure the success of radio in the UK throughout the decades. So it is to be celebrated. You're all why live listening is still so popular, why there's such origination going on with podcasts and on-demand music, and why millions of listeners continue to choose to share their lives with us every day. And I'm going to end with, you know, as the producer and director Hallie Flanagan said many years ago, the power of radio is not that it speaks to millions, but it speaks intimately and privately to each one of those millions. And I do think that is why the power of audio is still so potent today.
It certainly is. And that was a message shared by Richard Dawkins. Richard is Bowers President of Audio, who spoke about the versatility of audio in this modern era.
I think we see that audio ports very easily as a medium across platforms and across devices. So as new devices come along and new platforms, there's real opportunity then to find the right type of audio to sit on those platforms. So we've obviously been spending a lot of time on working with connected platform organisations, ensuring that our content is readily available in all of our different markets. But we've also been very busy in content. As I say, we see a really bright future in radio, so we continue to innovate in the broadcast portfolio. And then in terms of our commercial monetization, markets move at different speeds, and we're very sensitive to that. But you will see how across all of our different markets, we're building new products and services to essentially deliver greater engagement for our advertisers. And here in the UK, that's Octave, but we have products in other markets as well.
And so, I mean, when you look at your rivals and you look at the market in general, you're obviously a company with a lot of heritage. But what do you think? What do you think of yourself? What distinguishes Bauer in your approach, your mindset, compared to the your rivals?
I think our European profile is a real advantage. We see the diversity of cultures across our nine different markets. They all share very similar passions and, you know, business models, and there's a kind of Bauer culture. You know, we're all very passionate, and we're all big believers in team working, etc. But I think by seeing these different cultures and different markets, it makes us really sensitive to always putting the listener first and also putting being very close to our customers. And for us, having this kind of local market presence is a real defining characteristic. What being part of a bigger group allows is investment, it allows sharing of knowledge, creativity, and getting that combination right, I think, is something that we're doing well at the moment.
Richard and Charlotte were our first two keynote speakers, and we'll come to the third and final, Tom Connaughton, the MD of Spotify UK and Ireland, a little bit later. But while we're on the subject of innovation, one of our sessions this year was titled Are We Too Late for Gen Z? With Jay Richards, co-founder of Imagine Insights, and this panel of Gen Z creators who talked about the value of raw audio that hasn't been edited too much.
So my name is Adesi. I am a writer, development producer and podcast host, and I'm a screenwriter in general, so yes.
Love that. And Paul, what about you, my friend?
My name is Paul. I'm a trainee solicitor and I also host and produce my own podcast, which is a football business podcast that goes behind the scenes.
Love that. Absolutely love that. So they're both within the space that you guys care about, which is always a good idea, right? So before we kick off, and I ask these guys a few questions, I've got two statistics that I think are quite important. The first one is 89, so this is all directly from our community. We got this insight directly from our community. So 89% of our community agree that the audio sector has had a revival. Everybody, you can breathe. Because you're all panicking, right? You're like, what's he going to come talk about? Is he going to tell us what everything's going to be disappearing? No, 89% of our community say that the audio sector has had a revival, which is great, and we'll deep dive into that in a second. But the one that's interesting is 32% of our community value raw and honest content with less editing. I know you're having heart palpitations. What do you mean less editing? What is that? But we're going to deep dive on that one first. Adesi, I'm going to come to you first, my friend. Why do you think audiences prefer raw, less edited content?
Raw, less edited content tends to feel more authentic, and I think this generation really values authenticity, things that feel genuine, and that's why TikTok is amazing, because it's everyday influencers, it's everyday people that we relate to. Regarding audio, I love listening to unedited content because it feels like I'm talking to my friends, even though I'm not actually involved in the conversation. So podcasts are great when you're doing things in the background or when something's happening and you're just like, yeah, I relate to that. That's cool. That's interesting.
I think that's, I love the idea when you're saying talking to your friends. And I think that's one of the things that I used to love about radio, and complete honesty, I haven't listened to radio for about 5 years, so I apologize. But, and when I speak to a lot of our community, it's not too dissimilar. But the interesting thing is, I like the idea of talking to your friends. Why do you like that? Why do you like that vibe of it feeling like you're talking to your friends?
Because everything is so digital at the moment, I feel like we've all kind of built these weird parasocial relationships with influencers and with presenters and all these people online. And it's I don't know how to describe it. It's just feeling connected to people that you don't know, but you kind of aspire to be like, or you hope that you can have some form of relationship with. So there's the side that there's like the celebrities that you're like, yes, I want to know what your life is like, I want to have a bit of insight. There's also the side of people who grew up like you, even though they're close enough, they're still far enough for you to still have a relationship with.
Amazing. Paul, what about you?
Yeah, so I think the key words that sort of Adesi mentioned there, authenticity, I think is so important, and also personality as well. And I think when it comes to content, authenticity is so important because it's a noisy world and there's so much content out there, but when you tap into authenticity and personalities, that's where that uniqueness comes out, and that's what makes content sort of stand out, really. And I'm a big believer in that, and I enjoy listening to content where it's raw, and it's raw because people are being their authentic selves.
Yeah, I think the probably the most commonly used word in the Gen Z space at the moment is authenticity. I don't even know, honestly, sometimes I'm like, what does that even mean? Like, what the hell are you even talking about? So, Paul, for you, when you say authenticity, what exactly are you meaning?
By authenticity, to me, that effectively means the ability to just be yourself in the content. So, for example, with a podcast, it's so easy for you to change the way in which you speak, change the way in which you communicate in terms of with your co-host, for example, or with your guest or your line of questioning, but just tapping into who you are as a person, because that will resonate with the listener. Because at the end of the day, when we're talking about audio, we're talking about a very personal piece of content. And I think that's really important.
We've already heard a fair bit about the power of audio, with some of our speakers suggesting it's had a bit of a resurgence. Another thing that's battled back is the Eurovision Song Contest. Audience figures in this country are sky high, and the UK's entrant this year, Sam Ryder, stormed to second. A man at the heart of the BBC's coverage is passionate Eurovision superfan and BBC Radio 1 legend Scott Mills. And this year, we brought the two together for a chat.
Absolutely no shade here to any music bosses or any former Eurovision acts, but I found... No. They were all good in their own way. But we all know that the Eurovision song can be a slightly tricky sell to a radio station. So what do you think was different this time?
There was definite, like, a sense of allyship with radio in general for the campaign. So you would obviously, I don't know if anyone in this building knows the full story, but Scott called me and kind of convinced me, or maybe put to rest my worries, because there are worries doing something like Eurovision. We're both incredible, like, big fans of it, but still, because of the, I guess, like, the stigma that it has of, like, the career ender or the poison chalice, there's a certain trepidation of saying yes to it. But we had that lovely phone call.
Yeah, it was 2 hours 20
yep.
on a Sunday.
Yep. And heavy for a Sunday. My roast was freezing.
But it was a difficult one for you, because obviously, and other countries in Europe, as we know, don't have this stigma. Mm-hmm. But there is, and it did exist, and still does exist, of like, oh, well, that's going to be the end of you. And you were on the edge of something huge. Look at the TikTok followers. You've been signed by a record label. So if I was you, if I was an artist, it's definitely in the balance of, like, would I do this or would I not do this?
Yeah.
You know?
And I think there was like a crossroads of, do you play it safe, or do you go and sort of explore this open goal that's legitimately been left completely open? No one really wants to do it, and you can't not see the opportunity that was lying there. And more so as a fan, because to turn down something that you're such a big fan of because you're afraid it doesn't look cool, I think it goes against what so many of us would probably love to say that we stand for. You know, like, if we love something, we go and do it with our whole heart. If it doesn't, you know, if it's true to ourselves and our spirit. So to not do that because you were chasing coolness or success would have just been fundamentally wrong. And I think I would have, well, no, now I would have regretted it.
Yeah. What role do you think radio played in the campaign?
Like I said just now, like, that allyship. Like, it really, when you've taken the dive and the plunge to do something where you're a bit sort of, you know, you've said yes and the phone goes down, you're like, okay, bugger, I'm doing it. This is it. But then to have that support immediately, like, it just, it kind of thinks, makes you realise that, you know, I've got friends here, I've got support, I've got people that believe, people that are also massive fans, and they just have this ambition and passion for this project to do well. And knowing that you're not on your own, it, you know, you walk onto that stage essentially on your own, but you're not at all. There's such a team, and that was radio. It felt like home, going to do, like, coming to chat with you and Chris and going to all the networks and having that space where people were actually enthusiastic, and you didn't see that glazed look in their eyes where, like, oh God, here's the new lamb to the slaughter kind of thing. I mean, to be honest, that was a certain feeling right at the very beginning, but some of those looks were coming from people that I knew that they were fans of Eurovision, and they had just become slightly jaded, like we all have, like, at times become. And that was actually a really nice challenge, to have that resistance, not just going to do an interview where you're like, so what's next for you, or how's it going? It was an actual conversation, like, no, let's discuss, like, why we're not treasuring this wonderful thing. And that made it way more exciting.
Yeah. I'm obviously, you saw that we first connected on an Instagram Live, which was in lockdown, which you saw at the start of that video. And I'll be honest with you, there were, this year in particular, there were some other big names in the frame, or a couple of big names in the frame for the contest. But I just had, you know, when you have to sometimes go with your gut feeling? Yeah. And that's what I said to you on the phone that day. I was like, this is not going to turn out bad. And I just had a feeling.
See, I wasn't totally sure of that because some people were telling me, yeah, there's a few other people that want to go for it. But then I found out that some of those people hadn't ever got the phone call when I met them and spoke to them. So yeah. There's always a bit of like plumping.
Oh, yeah. Apparently you were going to do Eurovision.
There's loads of people want to do it. If you don't say yes, you can lose out.
And if you want to hear Scott talking to me on this very podcast about his 24 years on BBC Radio 1, scroll back after you've done with this one. Right, two clips back to back next. Very shortly, we'll hear from Labour MP turned podcaster Jess Phillips. But first, while we're on the subject of news and current affairs, let's hear from BBC Radio 4 Woman's Hour presenter Emma Barnett, who won Best Speech Presenter at the 2022 ARIAs. Emma spoke to Harriet Scott.
Going back to the moment when you won Best Speech Presenter at the ARIAs this year, what do you think helped get you there this time?
I'm laughing because I've since revealed that I had been through a medical procedure about 8 hours earlier. So I was actually on quite a lot of drugs, which was maybe different drugs to other people, but I don't know. So I just thought, right, OK, I've got to get on stage and get off stage. I genuinely am unaware of what I said on that stage. Because I have been very open about my IVF experiences, and I had had my egg retrieval that day, and I was not going to miss the ARIAs because a lot of your life when you're doing fertility treatment is controlled by a medical schedule that is unrelenting. So I was even more thrilled to win because it was a new job with a new team, and I had worked we had all worked exceptionally hard on it. But I was also happy I stayed upright. So there were two things going on there. And your question about to get to that point, I mean, I think no matter how small the interview is, I'm always trying. I mean, small in size, you know, minutes, as well as perhaps you might not know the person or it's a bit quirky item. I'm always trying to find a bit of an edge or a bit of something that you can take away from the programme and maybe have to talk about afterwards or just put in your mind.
I also mentioned to you, because just meeting you probably for the first time this morning, that I think you come across as just fearless and fabulously brave. And you've done some incredible jobs previously, but when you take on the juggernaut that is Woman's Hour and your predecessors, you don't take them on, but you're taking on that you've had many...
I'd welcome them all to the programme. Many, quite a show, wouldn't it?
Did you find that a hell of a responsibility? Did you ever consider saying no to it?
No. I think it's something that you... Though, because it's such a big part of the Radio 4 and the podcast landscape now, you want to do it well. You know, you want to do it the way that you think could work. And I think putting the listeners at the heart of it, it's now a full hour, and having a relentless focus on exclusivity is a very big part of what I hope to continue to bring.
Which brings us nicely onto Kate Bush.
There was Kate Bush.
I mean, there's Kate Bush.
There was Kate
Bush. She doesn't
speak
to anybody.
She was there.
She doesn't speak to anybody.
She's hello, Emma, it's Kate. I said, oh, hello.
Was that exciting to speak to her?
It was. Sometimes things align, but I have, you know, I don't know. Do other people have this? I'm sure many, we've got producers in the room. I have a list on my phone of people that I want to have on the programme or any programme, and it's constantly... I'm putting yeses and nos, I'm putting maybes, I'm putting the next thing, and she would be on what I would call my longest bid list. And I was absolutely thrilling to be able to talk to her, in some ways about almost just hearing what Kate Bush did during lockdown, which is part of what came up. You want to know, I certainly wanted to know. So that was, it was lovely to just hear her on the phone.
Who is the top of your list right now?
Well, I'm not telling you the very top because I don't want to say for others. I think we need to get J.K. Rowling on Woman's Hour.
I think
there's a lot that she has said, but there's not a lot she said in conversation or in dialogue or in interview. That Twitter and other social media platforms give us a great platform, and yes, you do reply, but you're not in an exchange or an interview. So she would be one. I have tried for quite a while to get Monica Lewinsky on many programmes that I've worked on. I still think there's more to say almost now with some of the way the climate has developed.
God, it would be different.
And you know, very rightly, she's very wary of the media. That there are about 27 others on that list at the moment, I think, if I'm to be precise. But I won't go through all of them.
What are the transferable skills between your day job, as it were, and what you do in your podcast? Or is it semi-permeable?
It is completely transferable. I have to tolerate less dickheads in doing the podcast. considerably fewer.
It's just hard to get her to open up, though, isn't it, Jess? That's the problem I always get. It's like... so political about stuff.
But look, the reality is there's something about having, and whether people, when they come on, realise it or not, there is something about the way that I am a bit famous. It's not the fame bit, it's the fact that I have a status in society because I am an elected representative. And it's the same way my constituents feel about me or people who write to me. It's a reverence that people don't even know that they have. Mm. That imbues, weirdly, you're going to think that this is weird, that you're trustworthy and that there is a level of, almost like a level of confidentiality when they're talking to you.
Like a priest or something.
Like a priest.
It's a similar kind of confessional thing.
Yeah. And so the main transferable skill, which largely comes from years actually before being a Member of Parliament and working with incredibly vulnerable people and expecting them to sort of bare their soul to you within the first 5 minutes of them meeting you, I have to do that all day, every day. People come to my office in their hundreds every week to tell me their deepest, darkest fears and the things that they've been frightened to admit to other people. And so you have to learn very, very quickly the sort of techniques of making people open up and feel that. And usually it's asking very, very basic and simple questions. I worked for years with victims of domestic violence, and people think that you can go to training and be trained to say, to be brave enough to ask the question about if somebody's a victim of domestic violence. But all you have to do is say, is everything all right? Mm. It's not rocket science, actually, to get people to tell you things about them. And what I found on the podcast is that people will immediately act with me as if that we've been friends for years and years and years. And there's an element that people think that they know you, like anybody in the public eye. But it's just, I mean, often I'm sat in my conservatory wearing pyjamas, vaping away on the Zoom call. So it seems like a relaxed environment. What my husband says, it's like living in a laudanum den.
A laudanum den. Just plumes of cinnamon smoke everywhere.
I think that it's really transferable, the idea that you have to get to people's feelings about things very, very quickly and that they feel that they can trust you.
Jess Phillips talking to the brilliant Sean Keaveney there as we take a look back at some of the highlights from this year's Radio Academy Festival. Now, we've had the news, so in traditional radio style, let's go to the sport. TalkSport's team were also on the ARIA's winners stage. TalkSport's breakfast presenter, Laura Woods, spoke about the highs and lows of following England's journey to the European Championship final in a Euro 2020 tournament delayed by the pandemic. Laura was also joined by TalkSport's co-commentator and presenter, Leanne Sanderson, and the station's main football presenter, Adrian Durham.
We were so lucky that whole tournament, because England had done so well and got all the way to the final. It was a dream, wasn't it? Like, the whole summer, that month was just amazing. And it is different. You do feel different. That summer was, you'd wake up every morning and you would be in a good mood because you know that everyone else is in a good mood and it was sunny and there was so much to talk about. You're riding this wave of a whole tournament. Tournament football's like nothing else. And then the morning after, I was at the final, the morning after, that was hard. Mm. It was hard to get up. We start the show at 6 and it was hard to find the right tone because normally on that breakfast show, you've got to be upbeat no matter what happens. I just did not feel like being upbeat at all. It was so depressing, wasn't it? And then we had to cover it from what actually happened. So not only did England lose, but the surrounding area of Wembley and what was happening on the ground at Wembley, if you were fans, you couldn't ignore it. It was horrendous. There were fights. You guys were all there on Wembley Way as well at Box Park. The way that some of the fans were behaving was terrible, and the state of Wembley as well, with all the glass on the floor and kids trying to get through the mess. We had Greg Dyke on, the former FA chair, and he essentially said on air, "I didn't see anything. It was fine." And we were like, wow. And that was an interview that was going up live. And you have these moments when you cover something like that. You've all experienced them before where you sort of stop for a second. You're like, I can't actually let that go. But I have a lot of respect for this person. But millions of people are listening. And I was there and I know what I saw. So you have to challenge it as it comes in. So it was a really strange morning that morning. There were lots of different things we had to cover in the right way.
Yeah, Leanne, I want to know about what it was like being there on Wembley Way. But I believe we've got some audio with you. Should we have a little listen?
I mean, I think what Gareth's done that other managers weren't able to do, like Capello, is bring the divide back again. I think the fans at times, you know, Wembley wasn't even getting sold out. You know, there was almost that fans were losing their love for the country. And I think Gareth Southgate has really brought that back again. And I think it's really good when you see, you know, I know Bukayo Saka on the unicorn and people might laugh, but these guys are allowed to have fun. And I think it's great to see them playing with a smile on their face because it's...
I mean, that's great.
It wasn't a real unicorn.
Okay, any similarities from being on the pitch to then the airwaves?
I mean, I think obviously being at Box Park, I was fortunate enough to be there every single England game and the atmosphere was absolutely incredible every single game. And then we'd throw to Adrian and the guys within the stadium and it was fantastic and it was brilliant. And I was able to do it this summer as well with the England team, with the women's and the Lionesses. But I think, as Laura said and touched upon, you know, at the final last year with the men's, we actually moved the show inside because people were throwing stuff at us on the balcony. It was with David Seaman and, you know, the fans were just climbing the stuff, throwing, booting footballs at us and that type of stuff. And people might laugh. We had to move the show within, whereas it was complete night and day from the Lionesses to the men's team. You know, I was walking from Box Park on Wembley Way to an apartment that I was doing a Channel 4 interview at before the final, and it was scary. And I felt quite threatened. You know, people were throwing beer in the air, bottles of beer, and it was just a really hostile atmosphere. So for me, you know, that was the real downfall, I think, of the tournament. But this year, with the Lionesses, I think it's shown you what people can do. You know, the final was at Wembley. There was no one's talking about the negativity. The day after, yes, we won. But even still, you know, that's unfortunate that was kind of the focus after the men's final was that, whereas the women and the Lionesses, you know, it wasn't like that.
Tell me about that win. What was it like for you?
I mean, we were on air. I cried. You know, being a former Lioness myself, played against Germany at Wembley in front of 65,000 people, got beat 3-0 5 years ago, got beat 6-2 in 2009 in the final against Germany. But I think what was quite fascinating is a lot of people didn't even know that we played in that final. And that goes to show you that the coverage, you know, in 2009, how much better it's got. And the fact that TalkSport were at every single stadium. You know, I said to these guys, I don't know how you go around the grounds every single, because I was absolutely shattered. I'd get up and do the breakfast show the next day. And I'm going, Woody, I don't know how they do it. Waking up at 4 in the morning. I was getting back at 3, waking up and doing it. But we love what we do.
Yeah.
You know, and it was an absolutely amazing atmosphere. But I did cry on air because I feel like it was almost like being a player and lost so many times, not just with the women's team, but the men's team. Not won anything since 1966. And we both cried, didn't we?
Yep.
And Sam cried. I think Sam out of face. You don't
cried.
Mind me saying that, do you?
No.
I think my lip was quivering. I was trying to hold it together. And I said, I can't hold it together.
Laura Woods and Leanne Sanderson talking to Soumaya Mughal. Now, let's go back to some music stations. In a moment, we'll hear from the team at KISS. But first, the boss of Six Music, Sam Moy.
Six Music, the BBC pop music station for those with a curious spirit, whose music taste lies beyond the mainstream. You know, the one that was nearly closed. Closure, the elephant in the room, the paragraph always written, the question always asked. I'm here to tell you, not today, my friends. Instead, you're going to hear what defines Six Music right now. A radio station that is passionate about the music it plays and who it is playing it to. A digital radio station that today is the biggest in the UK. We found and we grew our audience because we are really clear on who we are. We're the obsessives, the collectors, the admirers of artists pushing through boundaries or just ignoring them, who set themselves apart and who are singular and who subvert the status quo of what might be popular at a particular moment in pop culture. And where they lead, inevitably others follow. We love music, and we try to play it all.
Punk, funk, blues, soul, hip-hop, rock and roll, techno, go-go, electro, soco, balling indie guitar, drum and bass, reggae, ska.
And on occasion, death gospel. And we play an awful lot of it. Last year, Radio Monitor identified that a typical commercial radio station, on average, would play 2,700 different tracks. Six Music played over 19,000. On average, 80% of the music on our playlist is signed to an independent label. And according to this year's gender disparity report in UK radio, published by Why Not Her, 50% of Six Music's most played music is by women. In the UK marketplace, we are pretty much the exception and not the rule. So, Six Music sits apart. We challenge what is expected on a radio station. We do things differently and we do them on purpose. We play Joy Division's Unknown Pleasures in full on vinyl at 11:30 in the morning. We celebrate Japanese breakbeat club culture on a Saturday afternoon when the footy's on. We put together a show dedicated to shoes and we call it Cobblers. We invite an unsigned punk rock band from Bristol who'd been going for 5 years to play a half an hour set at drive time because Steve Lamack once walked into the Thekla and finally found the band that matched the sound in his head. Idols haven't done too badly since. Uncompromising artists and what they make have a home at Six Music. So too does some unrivaled talent. Marianne Hobbs lay her job on the line to get an interview with an unknown band to be on the front cover of the NME. Giles Peterson is one of the UK's original champions of underground club culture. Don Letts introduced Bob Marley to punk. Steve Lamack has been at the birth of every British band, from Blur and Coldplay to Idols and Wet Leg. Many radio stations these days play Lizzo. Lauren was 10 years ago. Iggy Pop is our Sunday afternoon presenter. Iggy Pop.
Hi, my name's Sam Bailey and I'm the Managing Director of the Radio Academy. And I'm just going to interrupt Christian for 2 minutes to let you know that applications are open now for the Radio Academy mentoring programme supported by Broadcast Bionics. Mentoring can seriously boost your career and RAMP will give you 6 sessions with an industry leader from another part of the sector, as well as a support structure with all your fellow mentees on the scheme. But don't take my word for it. Here's Emily, who was part of RAMP 2022.
My name is Emily Finch. I'm a freelance radio producer and my mentor was a senior executive at BBC Radio 4. It was a really positive experience to get to know my mentor. I did find it quite scary at first because my mentor was such a senior figure. In a way, that was beneficial to meet with them on a regular basis and to find out that they were actually just a normal person. I had a long-term goal that we set out at the start and kind of smaller objectives that I would work towards within each session, which I found incredibly helpful and helped me kind of break down exactly what I wanted to achieve during the mentorship scheme. I got out so much from the cohort relationship. We met as a group of rampers every week. You know, you just learnt so much about a section of the industry that I didn't really know much about. And we're still in touch with each other regularly on WhatsApp. We have a WhatsApp group and we still rely on each other, especially if we're having a particularly bad week. It's always good to know that there are people within the industry that you could speak to in a confidential way. It has turbocharged my career because it's given me the confidence to apply for jobs that I previously didn't think that I was qualified to do, and I really recommend it.
If you like the sound of turbocharging your career, the Radio Academy mentoring programme supported by Broadcast Bionics might be just the thing you need. Applications are open until the 10th of October and all the details are on our website. And if you want to know more, our mentoring director, Hannah, is hosting a Zoom webinar all about RAMP on Monday the 3rd. Register for that and find out more at radioacademy.org.
Hello, I'm Tatum. So this is the KISS family right here. Where are we on the schedule? So I am on in the afternoon, Monday to Saturday. Kaylee on KISS Fresh, you can find her on the weekends. We've got Andy, Kissery legend, also on the weekends, and Elle's KISS Fresh as well. So basically, I guess like what Emma said, we want to kind of go through our superpower at KISS, actually, and hopefully kind of carry on a conversation for yourselves, if there's some bosses out here, I'm sure there are, after we've kind of spoke here on diverse routes into radio. So I feel like we should start with you, Els, because yours is totally different. So you are a Man City presenter, YouTuber, gamer, you got a podcast as well. How did you end up here?
My route was a bit weird as well. So I worked in an office. So I was working at IBM doing computing. I'd just graduated. And I used to upload onto Instagram just me complaining about everything, because that's how I got my nickname, the bitch, just because I complain about everything. And I would be on my commutes just in the morning, like 9 to 5. And someone from Rinse FM found me on Instagram, just basically chatting shit. And he was like, oh, you're quite funny, but you're not ready yet. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but okay, never presented before. He came back 6 months later and he's like, do you want to come in for a meeting at Rinse? And I hadn't really heard of Rinse because I'm not from London. And I was like, why not? So off I went, had a meeting, and then they gave me my own radio show.
So you got scouted, just to clarify here, you got scouted from chatting shit on your Instagram stories.
Yes, I did, yeah, just by complaining about everyday things in life. So I had a show on Rinse for about a year, a talk show, didn't play any music because I don't know how to DJ or anything. Never presented before either, I just presented to like bankers. So I did that, then I started my own YouTube channel where I play video games, and that really, really took off. And I didn't have time to do radio anymore. So I stopped doing the radio, started the YouTube, lockdown happened, everyone was at home playing video games, and my YouTube blew up as well. And then during lockdown, got contacted by Kiss Fresh because they're a digital radio station that were looking for new presenters. And my audience was also young and into video games and music and everything. So it kind of just made sense.
Kaylee Golding, I feel like you're on every radio station out there. If you turn on the radio, there's like a 50-50% chance that you're going to find Kaylee. You're on Kiss Fresh, you're on Hits Radio Pride, you got loads going on. I don't know how you wangle that into your contract, I'll be honest. Doing well. So your kind of journey is kind of a mixture of like both traditional and content, right? So let's start from the beginning. How did it all happen?
So I wanted to be a producer originally, like it was all about production for me. But obviously in student radio, especially because I'm very much into black music, no one on the student station was really doing black music shows. So I was like, oh, I'm going to have to produce and present my own show. But little did I know, I'd fall in love with presenting as well. So I did the traditional route as in like student radio, community radio, and just like pestering every boss possible with demos. And I did that, but what was also important with me is building my own social media brand and really putting out content that I love. So whether that be representing my hometown, Birmingham, representing LGBTQ plus communities, or doing interviews with amazing black music artists that I love, it was important for me to make sure that I'm putting out that content as well. So when I'm walking through the doors at places like Kiss or Hits Radio Pride, they know what they're going to get because I've been doing it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I get to do content that I know and love, and people know and love me for that content now. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to make sure that as well as doing the traditional route, you're also putting out content out there. So when you are walking through these doors, they know what they're getting, but also for the bosses as well. So when you are bringing this talent in, don't try and change them. And that's what I love, like at Kiss and Hits Radio Pride, they just leave me to do my thing. Like they just leave it. If a Birmingham track's playing, I'm going to hype it up to the dozen. I know the rest of the country's listening, but I don't care about that. I care about Birmingham in that moment. Nice. And like Rebecca knows I'm going to do that. Do you know what I mean? So it's important not to try and change the presenters that you've got once they're walking through your door, because what's the point of mixing things up and diversity and inclusion if you're going to try and make them sound different?
Our next festival speaker, John Holmes, spoke to us on this podcast about a month or so ago about absolute radio pirates. But right now, here he is chatting about his BBC Radio 4 show, The Skewer, which takes topical audio and, well, plays with it. Here's John with some air.
So, on to politics, and you alluded to this earlier on, it's all kicking off. It can be quite divisive as well, and I know that you take aim at quite a few high politicians. So how do you make sure that listeners across the spectrum can be involved and laugh along with it? I know that you did mention this earlier on, that it's not woke, it's not this or that other, but how have you managed to maintain that?
Well, I think it's what we're trying to do, really, is just hold a mirror up to everything that's going on. Mm. You know, that's a sound mirror, if you will. That's pretentious. World War II on the Kent coast. It's a case of just going, look, we all know what's going on. here it is, right down the middle.
Do you get much backlash? Do you get many people in touch sort of complaining?
Only the BBC's compliance officers. That's mostly them. No, not really. I mean, there are, because of the vocal lobbies there are about various subjects, so the gender debate or whatever it might be, you know, that people get very antsy about on social media, we've done stuff on both sides of that, again, without taking a point of view. We've just gone, right, here's that and here's that. Make your own mind up. That's the rule. The listener, we're just presenting it all mixed up and spat back out with jokes. You make your own mind up about your feelings about it. We're not saying right, wrong, left, right. We're not saying anything. So, yeah, it stirs up some stuff sometimes, but inevitable, isn't it, that that's going to happen, especially with comedy.
What's the most difficult thing when you're popping an episode for The Skewer together?
What's the most difficult thing? Yeah. It's the phone call I'm waiting on now, which is compliance. calling okay. me up, which inevitably will happen, where they go, right, how are you going to justify that? And I'll have to make something up.
But you've managed to do it.
There are a couple of occasions. I'll give you another for instance, right? This is the one we did have to cut from the last series, right? We had Boris Johnson talking about everything that was going on, right? And it was a shambles of Brexit and Northern Ireland. And the news that week was all about that and Partygate and everything else. And we'd mixed it in with a clip from Fleabag, okay? And it ended where, and there's lots of Boris doing this, and Fleabag was arguing with Boris Johnson. We'd taken out, she was having a chat with her sister on a park bench in the scene. We'd replaced her with Boris Johnson, and this conversation was taking place. And it ended with a famous Fleabag line where he just said something. She went, oh, he's such a c-. Right? And compliance said, well, because we've had the seat, it's quite a sweary show.
Yeah.
But the shout out to the controller of Radio 4, Mohit, who's brilliant with this sort of stuff. But he did phone me up and he went, yeah, just a thought. Look, you know, we are in an election week and I had a local election. I don't think that the nation's flagship speech station can blatantly call the Prime Minister one of those. Just fair enough. We changed it to shithead, I think, so it's fine.
I wonder if the timing was different, whether the outcome would have been different on that one. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it was possibly... I don't know. It's difficult to say, isn't it?
But it's great that you're trying and you're pushing it out that far, and I think it's needed and it's important, and it's kind of where, I don't know, you sort of push the boundaries of... Oh my God, I sound so like, oh, you push the boundaries of creativity. But no, I think it's, do you know what I mean? Oh, get in the bin, Smayer. But I think it's, the thing is important that you try and that you hear it.
Well, it's. I think what's interesting about it and what it's become in a way, and which was a pure accident really, was the fact that just, as I say, it's a reflection of what's going on, but quite different to everything else out there, because most of that is panel games, like Have I Got Any Fuel or you know, whatever they might be. But the idea of just taking what exists... I mean, we couldn't have made this show, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, partly because technology didn't exist to do it in the way that we do it, because there's a lot of audio. I mean, the comedy's one bit. There's a lot of sound design and a lot... You know, they both come together quite uniquely, probably, in there. So it's a lot of sound geeks as well as comedy geeks and angry people. But also, the laws changed. So until, 2014... we couldn't even do it because parody law didn't exist.
John is always extremely entertaining. Now, in a second, we will hear from our final keynote speaker, Tom Connaughton, MD of Spotify UK and Ireland. But next to the team behind Bars, a fascinating programme for National Prison Radio, hosted by Lady Unchained and made by the team at Folded Wing, Carl Boss and Karen Pearson. The team spoke to Danielle Perry.
Radio is, you know, first thing is sometimes thought of as entertainment, isn't it? This also is a really important audio project, isn't it? In terms of the people you were talking to and creativity and writing and access to shows like this. How did you find that from a presenting perspective?
So obviously I do a lot of work in prisons, and during that time, obviously, like we said, it was lockdown. So in prison, it was 23-hour bang up. And so there was no creativity, no exercises being done or dealt with. And if they were, it was like, hopefully you get the worksheet and you can get involved. So this show for me was absolutely amazing because it got people that, you know, people in prison actually want to listen to. I'm happy they listen to me, but it's always nice when they know the person that's coming on and to actually really deep dive into how that person gets to the point of maybe they did do a prison sentence and now they're out and they're, you know, they're being amazing artists. And it's just, for me, it was absolutely amazing to just show people in prison that regardless of the times, regardless of what's going on, we can still create creativity and grow while we're in prison and hopefully take that out into the real world, but also to show these artists were saying their truth. Like, you know, we had people, you know, like Hack Baker, who was very honest about his words. And for me, on my original show, Free Flow, I get listeners, they call in and I have to give them feedback. And so I had to be very, even though they were celebrities, I had to pull up some words that, you know, if my listeners heard that, they'll be like, well, Lady Unchained, you didn't tell them off about that line, you tell us off. So it was very important for me to say, but you know when you said this line, what did you mean by it? You know, and it was always interesting to have that conversation because people in prison really understood it.
Yeah, the relatability is so important, isn't it? We have a clip, actually, from Matt Hack Baker we're going to play right now, who came on the podcast to share his wisdom on creating. Let's hear it now.
I'm skint, not even a little bit, I'm talking flat on my face, geezer, man, I'm skint. Until my phone rings, I'll be praying for a saving grace, but I'm skint.
Bro? Can I just say, yeah, the way you put words together is absolutely incredible. And obviously, I had to pick it up. And the reason I picked that line is because you're going to understand this when I say this. Obviously, when you said, until the phone rings, I'll be praying for a saving grace, fella, I'm skint. Now, that phone call for our listeners, for me and you, in certain areas, like I'm from Southeast London, Council Estate, obviously. And that phone call that can help you not be skint no more could also be the same phone call that can lead you to do a prison sentence, I like.
Yes, 100%. Yes,
100%. I heard it, I was like, oi, this is my guy, bro. I'm like, what's going on? Like, can you just, like, take us back to, like, when you was writing that piece? Like, what was going on, like in your life?
Well, to be fair, like, I would enjoy myself a lot prior to that. And then it got to a point where I was like, you know what, we can't do this again. Suddenly, like, I thought, like, to really, really excel my life and to move on, like, we're going to have to sing songs, like. And I was like, really? And I was like, yeah, we're going to have to sing songs, bro. Like, honestly, this is what we've got to do.
But today I'm here to talk about the future. And that's why I jumped at the chance, really, when Rachel and team asked if we'd be here today, because we're really keen to share our thoughts on the power of audio for creators. And for us, I'm going to start at the top. This is our company mission, as stated by Daniel Ek, our co-founder and CEO. Our mission is to unlock the potential of human creativity by giving 1 million creators the opportunity to live off their art and billions of fans the opportunity to enjoy and be inspired by it. So what does that mean for audio and our efforts there? Well, we've spent a lot of time over the last 3 years or so investing in catalogue, investing in original content and programming. But what we've come to realise really is alongside that, in order for the audio industry to really flourish both creatively and economically, we really need to give the creators themselves the tools that they need to build their audiences and build their communities on the platform. And for us, that really starts with Anchor. Anchor's a company that we acquired in 2019. For those that don't know, it's a tool which allows podcast creators to create, distribute, and monetize their content for free. I think the for free is quite a key part there, because I think historically it's been, could be a costly enterprise, right, to record a podcast and get it distributed, certainly costly and maybe opaque. And Anchor has really brought two key things to Spotify. The first thing is catalog. So just to give you an idea, it's really supercharged the sort of catalogue that we've got on the platform. The pink line at the top here shows you the amount of podcasts being delivered to Spotify via Anchor, the grey via everything else. So it's really supercharged our catalogue. But more importantly than the sheer volume of podcasts, it's the innovation that it brings. Anchor provides the sort of the technological backbone for us to be able to start innovating and creating a platform for the audio creator of tomorrow.
On to our final two clips. In a moment, the exceptional Michelle Visage. She talks about her background and journey in radio. But next up, co-creator of the mega award-winning Have You Heard Georgia's podcast, Benbrick, with his talk called An Audio Obsession. Benbrick is a producer, creator and sound designer.
Now, I know you're all fascinated by audio like me. This is my kind of room to be in. I'm very pleased to be here. I tried to find a voice note on my phone on the way here and gave up because there was too many. And I was going to change the script, and then I did find a clip, though. It was recorded at Abbey Road. I'm there with George the Poet, and it shows the difference between being inside and outside of a soundproof room. Let's take a listen.
I know what you mean. Let's go downstairs.
Sorry, it's pretty basic. But I like to have things like that to reference, and we do stuff like that on the podcast all the time. If you heard chapter 2, you'll have heard this moment where we went from outside to inside at a party.
My brethren Clifton was a few years older than me. His sister V was cool and his big bro was a G. Long before I discovered the gift of wordplay, I was left speechless one time at Clifton's birthday. His big bro was playing songs that had a certain swagger. And the name of this genre, I later learned, was ragga.
So, by now, George and I have spent months in my studio, and I must have spent years in that one room. And still, every day when I go in and I turn the Mac on and hear the Mac startup sound, I can't help but think, if they'd have detuned it half a semitone, then it would sound exactly like the song Perfect Day. So literally, every day, that's what I'm thinking when I turn the Mac on in my studio, which is pretty great or pretty sad. Pretty great. Okay, that's not bad. Pretty sad. Oh my God, what an audience. Amazing. Yeah, these discoveries are satisfying. And if you'll indulge me, I want to go one level deeper. Because the other day I realized that my dishwasher beeps. In exactly the same key as this Yoko Kanno song, which I love. See? Amazing. You know they asked if I needed help writing my speech, and I said no. And now it's just like, what is he doing up there? All right. Focus. You don't need to be a sound master to master sound. What do you need? I think two things, perfectionism and putting yourself out there. And I know we have people here running companies and running departments, but I still think there's ideas that might resonate with you. Perfectionism and putting yourself out there are both crucial for anyone building a career in any area of audio.
Your connection with radio goes way back.
Way back.
And then you end up actually working at WKTU with, this is where you start working with RuPaul, as we,
right.
As we can see now.
So that was February of 96. I was, the record deal thing, we didn't sign a good record deal. It was a very bad record deal, worse than Supremes, worse than TLC, only we didn't have legs to stand on or money to fight it. So sadly, it ended the way it did, and I did a song on the Bodyguard soundtrack, which I wrote and I performed. It was the only non-Whitney song to make it into the movie.
Yes,
we brought it to Top of the Pops here, which, as we know, can make or break your career in one TV show, which is the weirdest thing I've ever heard of in my life, but it did have that power. And that was 92, and then at that point, it was like, I didn't know where to go, because they dumped out on the record. I was signed to Arista, Clive Davis signed me. We finished this record, and then my producers got in a fight with Clive, and they never delivered the record, so the rest is unheard of, and supposedly the masters were lost in a flood. It's been a long road. But the point is, my best friend in New Jersey called me. I was living in Manhattan, and she said, they're playing your music on this new radio station. It's all of our music, which would be dance music from the late 80s, early 90s, right? Yeah. That whole movement of Mars, Pump Up the Volume, all of, I can go on and on with that music, but you know what I'm talking about. And
all the house music from The Warehouse.
Not even that deep. It was more commercial dance, freestyle music that would be in New York. would be like, it didn't really make it, Latin freestyle didn't really make it to this part of the world, but a lot of the other stuff did. Rock Me On, Madeus, all those records.
Falco.
I know. All those records. And they were playing the dance music that I grew up on loving, that we would hear at clubs and teen nightclubs. And I called every single radio programmer that I met when I was in the girl group. Because at every radio station, radio has always fascinated me. So anytime Seduction did an interview, the girls would be like, we want to go home. We're stars. We don't do this. And I was like, can I do the traffic? So they would leave, and I would stick around to do traffic, weather, bits, anything I could do. I might have dated a boy here and there, and by dated, you know what I mean. Yeah. It was just a fun time in my life. I was 19 years old, 20 years old. So radio had always been super, super important to me. So when I had the opportunity to get a job on a radio station with absolutely zero radio experience, but I'm a what hustler with a capital H, I was not taken no for an answer. I called every radio programmer. And ironically, because this was the biggest launch of any radio station in the past 20 years, every single programmer I called was like, oh, I'm going to be working there. Oh, I'm going to be the music director. Oh, I'm going to... Not one of them had anything to do with it. And weirdly, I told my roommate, who was an exotic dancer at a place called Scores, and she said, you know, I think my boss is going to be working at that radio station. And I was like, right, your boss at the strip club is going to be working at the radio station. And I actually went for a meeting at the strip club with these two guys who were like, you know, and I was like, okay. And they actually were. They were going to audition.
Oh my gosh. So they in a strip club?
In a strip club. And they were going to audition for this 100,000-watt radio station. They were putting so much money into this stick. It was unbelievable. And what they did was called stunting in America. So they would audition for breakfast a week at a time with different personalities to see how the audience responded. And I started with the first one as a person out on the street. So I'd be like, hey, it's Michelle Visage at the Tesco. I'm giving away Radio 2 T-shirts. Come see me for the next half an hour. And if you say... I'll give you a free T-shirt. So it was that type of thing. And all the upper echelon were in town from Chicago. And they said, who's that girl?
Yeah.
Because I wasn't jaded or bitter or ruined by radio. Yeah. I wasn't what they wanted me to be. It's the truth, guys. So they brought me in the next week to be with somebody. And they said, we want you to do traffic with him. And I was like, cool. They said, you ever do traffic? I was like, yeah, a lot. So I was like just doing whatever I want. I remember there was a report of a car fire and I called it a barbecue and I was just doing all these things. No idea. The levity of the situation, the gravitas. And I was like, but they loved it. And then the third one that came in had somebody he wanted to bring with him. So I was like, oh no, somebody's going to get my job. And then the fourth one, they wanted me back. For the fourth, so this is week four of the stunting, and they bring us to a room, and they said, you know, you meet for your, to see how it's going to go, and in walks RuPaul, and I had known Ru from the club days, and he looks at me, I look at him, it was fashion week, and we were going to be broadcasting live from the Fashion Cafe, and he looked at me and said, of course it's Michelle Visage, all roads lead to Visage, and that's where our career started. They put us together, and the first ratings book, we beat Howard Stern. Yep. Now, I didn't know this. So I was on a SAG after a salary, and I didn't know anything about money or anything about ratings, so I did that first year for, like, a potato, basically.
But you do when you first start out. You literally will work for nothing.
And I did.
Yeah. And then many stations follow, because I don't think a lot of people know this in the fact that they see you on Drag Race and on TV shows. But you're a radio person.
Just so you know, I'm not just a random American. And just so you know, because I see a lot of, you know, bring back Tony Humphries. Let me tell you something right now. Tony ain't going anywhere. Tony is loved, okay? Gary is loved. They are major talent that we couldn't live without. My hat goes off to these people. But just so you're comfortable knowing, I have done only breakfast radio for 17 years. Through two pregnancies,
yes. Loved hearing about Michelle's radio journey, and I cannot think of a better person to end on. Really hope you've enjoyed this look back at this year's Radio Academy Festival. It was so great to bring so many different people from the industry we all love together in one building. But it is only possible thanks to our lovely Radio Academy members. Trust me, they're all lovely people, all of them. And you can be too, for just £3 a month. It doesn't just give you the warm glow of knowing you're supporting our mission to drive excellence in radio and audio, but you also get access to more than 100 videos of recent events and loads more. Just search Radio Academy membership. It is only £3 a month. And if you've got something brilliant going on that you think we should be sharing with the world on this podcast, email us podcast@radioacademy.org. And next week, another very lovely man, Rhys Parkinson, looks back on 20 years of One Extra. Find out how the station celebrated and just why Rhys and its loyal listeners think it's so special. I look forward to talking to you then. Bye for now.